It's The Bill Murphy Show. A daily one-on-one 30-minute interview featuring people from all walks of life. Available daily at BillMurphyShow.com. And now, here's your host, Bill Murphy.
With your digital broadcaster, Wednesday, March 30th, 2011. I got to get new intros done. Time to call Scotty and freshen those babies up a little bit. Scotty, if you're listening, be prepared. An email is on the way. My good friend Scott Chapin, take care of the intros there. Brought to you, as usual, by Lulu's Bait Shack. Fresh Florida seafood, gigantic fishbowl drinks, and live original music Wednesday nights. That will be resuming sometime in April. We will let you know what bands we have booked there in the not-too-distant future down at Lulu's on A1A in Beach Place in the heart of Fort Lauderdale Beach. Today, we talk a little photography as we welcome in a world-renowned, I suppose, at this point, one of the most successful sports photographers out there, and a number of things to talk with this guy about. Mark Sirota, how are you, buddy?
I'm doing well, Bill. Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, Ned. Thanks for coming on and bringing us such compelling content as we like to do. We spread it out and go in all different directions every day, and this is one direction that we have not gone in yet, so I couldn't think of anyone more appropriate to do this with me. Mark, if off the top of my head, I can introduce you to people as someone who's regularly seen on the major sports sidelines. Very enviable job there, and also in the heart of some very heavy duty news stories as well. For the most part, would you classify yourself as a freelancer because you're hired by so many different people to do so many different kinds of jobs?
I think you'd probably call it more of a contract photographer, because so many of the customers, clients that I work with, only work with freelancers that they sign to exclusive contracts.
Right.
It's mostly regional or sports sensitive. Like, I do a lot of work for certain clients in football and different clients in basketball, but I think you would categorize me as a contract photographer, hitman for hire.
Not that I expect you to be able to make the comparison that easily, but is this as cutthroat an industry as, let's say, you know, I could use the voiceover industry as for comparison, a very tightly knit circle of folks that you have to get in with, or is it something that if your talent is good enough, you get what you deserve?
No, you know what? It's a very tight circle, and I'm sure that you find that similar in your craft. You know, and for example, I work for one of the major wire services I work for, and I have worked for several years, is Getty Images. And Getty's just simply not giving out or signing people to any contributor contracts these days. I mean, they've got a steady stable of photographers, and you know, the only way I got in is several years ago. Obviously, they noticed me as a competitor. I worked for Reuters News Service for many years. But someone from Getty, who was a friend of mine, made a recommendation, and the weight of other photographer recommendations in my area is a lot heavier than any resume or even portfolio. You know, you got to be able to get along and work as a team. There's times when you're solo act and you're out there, competing with the Associated Press and Presswire and UPI and other wire services by yourself. But for the most part, especially at world champion sporting events, you're a member of a team.
Right.
And you got to be able to work well with other shooters, and in most cases, our teams have been together and done Super Bowls together for many, many years. And, so it is a very tight-knit fraternity, and it comes with a great deal of time and experience. What I would recommend for anybody who's interested in getting involved in it is what I did way back when I was at the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale, and that's internships. And I think that's probably similar in your business, where I interned for the Miami Herald for almost 2 years before I was really ready. And that's once I graduated from school, really ready to go out and think on my own, so to speak, and sort out competitive assignments.
Yeah, we're in agreement that interning is invaluable experience. The problem that's happening with interning, and not so much maybe in our businesses or in the entertainment industry, but in the regular workplace, interns are hired, and it seems like people are hanging on to interns for as long as they possibly can, knowing that the people appreciate the experience. And, you know, when I did it, it was, okay, you can do a semester, and we'll pay your credits for college, but then after that, you have to get paid, you know? So now I just think a lot of people exploit the situation with interns a little too much, you know?
Yeah, I do. And I think, you know what, Bill, I think part of that problem is nowadays, good interns are hard to find.
Right.
Because you're usually talking about people who have free time enough to be available
yep.
at the drop of a hat. For example, I lecture at the Art Institute Fort Lauderdale quite often, and I meet a lot of young photographers who want to assist and work with me. And I hire people, quite often in those capacities. But, you know, my steady assistant, the guy who's worked for me for about 6 years, initially worked for me for a couple of months, just wanted the experience. And
yeah.
now, you have to pay people, whether they're interning or not, in a lot of situations, because just the economics of it doesn't, you know, when I interned, I was living with my folks,
right.
you know, and
right.
people are, you know, I don't know whether parents are kicking kids out younger these days or what, but, you know, it's just not, you know, people have to get paid. And so good interns are sort of hard to find. So I think that makes certain people kind of hold on to them as long as they possibly can.
Yeah, you kind of threw it out there, but it's admirable, too, that you go back to the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale and kind of pay it back there for the experience you got there and pass along your knowledge to the students that are there today. I've kind of done the same thing with Connecticut School of Broadcasting. Whenever I can, go down there and teach a production course now and then. And I know the satisfaction that you get out of that. I can relate to it. So.
Well, you know, what's funny for me is I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for internships. And I wouldn't be here if I didn't receive help from other photographers,
right.
you know, back in my 20s. I mean, you know me very long time. I've always been... strong-willed, hard-working photographer, and I've always had an eye, but, you know, the Art Institute gave me the fundamentals, but it was one day in the middle of my education, after the first year and a half of my education, that I had a friend who was interning at the Miami Herald, and if he hadn't brought me down there and I just happened to meet a guy who to this day is now the highest newspaper job in the Washington Post, the top job in the country, if this guy hadn't recognized there was something special in me, and it's a long story how I actually got in, but it basically was I didn't have a portfolio. I convinced the graphics editor at the Miami Herald back in 89, I convinced him to give me a shot, and he sent me on an assignment without any portfolio. And now what's funny is he gave me a lesson. He said to me, you got till 10 p.m. to put a picture on my desk. And I got there with a really awesome shot of something that that he never expected, but I was there at like 10:05. So, after all the work I did and I had my shot, my big opportunity, he told me, you blew your deadline and come back in 2 years when you graduate, and we'll talk about giving you an internship then. And I drove home literally in tears, but when I got up in the morning, I had a phone call from him. And I just basically left him a business card that I had made, and he said, have you seen the newspaper today? And I said, no. And he said, go pick up the paper and call me back. And I picked up the paper, and my shot was on the front of the sports section. That's my first tear ever. And I called him back, and he said, you start your internship on Monday. And
wow.
I learned a lesson, it was all a lucky break because of who I knew, because of this one friend who said, come on down, let me introduce you to somebody. So I have a strong feeling about giving back, and I don't believe that anybody gets, you know, of any real position of success without help.
Yeah, and it sounds like he sure did the job of driving home the importance of meeting your deadline, and I bet you never missed one after that.
No, and in fact, you know, the only time I've missed a deadline since, that day in the late 80s was this past year. I was at Pro Player Stadium, Dolphin Stadium, Land Shark Stadium, whatever it's
Joe
called.
Joe Robbie Stadium. It goes on and on and on. You could use up the rest of the half an hour with all the names of the stadium.
And that's what's funny, too. You know, I've lived through all of it. I was out there when the stadium was being built. And, but I was out there on a Monday night game, and all my equipment got stolen during the game, first time in 25 years of covering football
wow.
at that stadium, and I couldn't get my pictures out until I got home, which was after midnight. And it's the only time in my entire career that I couldn't complete my task, and I tell you, that bothered me more and sticks with me more than the fact that I had to replace the gear, because you know, that point was driven home that day. Absolutely.
Still not a bad track record after all said and done. All right, now, we're, you know what? I think we're being just a little too serious here. You and I have been friends for a long, long time, and this conversation needs some lightening up. We will get back into the serious stuff, because I do want to get into the whole science behind photography. I want to get into where the talent kicks in and kind of talk to you about what separates the men from the boys in the industry, which I think will be an interesting conversation. We also want to talk about the adventures you've been on, both in the sports world and in the political and you know, world news arena, which is some exciting stuff. But let's just cut right to the chase here and give credit where credit was due. You basically got your start by taking photographs of my band back in the day, right?
Yes, I did. And, you know, I think it even came to the point where I just put it on the tripod, you focused it, you composed it, and I basically hit the self-timer. I mean, that's how well, you know, you spared me from my career.
Okay, now you're being a wise ass and giving me too much credit. Now, you were always everybody's got a friend that, you know, is always walking around with a camera, and back right. in the day, we're talking about the early 80s, at the risk of dating both of us. But you were always that guy that was around with a camera, and you were always, oh, we need a picture or something. Let's call Mark. You know, and then you were at gigs taking shots. You were, you know, we were doing the, trying to make up our own, you know, what do you call them, like promo shots and stuff.
Yeah.
And we're going out to weird locations and taking pictures. I know you learned a lot, because even at that early stage of your career, you were getting some pretty damn good shots.
Yeah. And I think that what it comes down to, and again, but you just said, in all seriousness, and you know, we are light because we're talking amongst friends here. But you know, having guys like you, a band that was really popular and, you know, at the time, and playing in front of crowds, whether the Button South or the Plus Five or wherever it was, you know, it that feel, that energy, that those moments, that's what makes strong photography. And there are moments like that in every time I pick up my camera. I mean, whether it's the last 30 seconds of a Super Bowl, or whether it's during a concert, and you know, and there's a moment that, you know, as a lead singer, you're looking in the right light, you know, the right light with the right color, with a light hidden behind you, and it's got a hard edge. There's moments in a portrait session. There's moments in journalism, and you know, having that opportunity at a young age. I mean, we were so young, and being able to you know, take my camera to a show like the kind you guys put on back then, as opposed to, you know, just shooting flowers in the backyard.
Yeah.
It's a huge advantage.
And you learned so much about, you know, high-speed film and low-level lighting and all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff. That, you know, you learned all the basics at such an early age, and now it's paid off, and here you are several decades later. And, you know, that kind of experience is, again, invaluable. It's even more valuable to you than interning is, to get a head start on even the, you know, the whole workforce part of it, you know?
Yeah, and you know, I shoot a lot of concerts these days. I did a book with Britney Spears several years ago, a coffee table book. I've done books with Casey and the Sunshine Band. I've done, you know, the biggest tours in the world. You know, I've done tour photography with U2 and Paul McCartney and Heart and, you know, so many different groups. And I'll tell you, you know, it's learning human nature. Again, you know, watching you guys back then, knowing the lead singer has this personality, knowing James had this personality, and Mark had this personality, and your brother Steve had his personality, and where to go to make pictures, and not to shoot the singer while he's in the middle of a note because you're going to get the microphone in his mouth.
Right.
Those kind of things, you know, they teach you human nature, and you also predict what's going to happen before it happens, and that's how you make moments.
Right. Now, to kind of expand on that a little bit, I want to get into, this might be a little cerebral for a photography conversation, and I hope I word it correctly, and then I guess you'll be faced with the same challenge in responding here. You can look back at any number of famous photographs that you've seen over the years, and you know, of course, the sports ones come to mind. The years and years ago, the shot of Muhammad Ali standing over Joe Frazier, I think it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Neil Leifer.
And I believe Lynn Swann with that leaping catch in the end zone against the Cowboys in the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you see these moments, and they're pictures that make you just stare at them for 20, 30 seconds, a minute, 2 minutes, looking at all the little details. You see, oh my God, the ball is 1 inch away from his hand. And it gets me to wonder whether the photographer at the time knew that the shot was going to look like it did when he took it. Now, I know it's instantaneous and the action's moving so quickly in front of you, but do you know, or is, and I guess what I'm trying to do here is reach for you to admit that sometimes you really do get lucky, or do you know every microsecond of time that went by when you took that shot and you knew before you developed it what it was going to look like?
Well, now it's a great question, Bill, and now you're crossing over to technology through the years, because back in the day when I started, we were shooting film.
Right.
So you didn't know if you had the picture for sure, especially if it was in focus, because we didn't have autofocus either.
Right.
You manually focused your cameras, you hand wound your cameras, and you put film in your cameras. All three things that when I lecture at the Art Institute and I look at students and explain this to them, they look at me like I have three heads.
Right. So, hey, and not to go off on too much of a tangent, I really want you to pick up where you left off, but I can draw a huge parallel with my business. I mean, I started out editing with razor blades and tape, and now we're all in the digital world, and I teach students this, and they look at me with their heads tilted going, what are you talking about? So I know,
right.
I know what you mean.
Right, and while I answer that question, let me just add that being out in front of that technology, understanding the fact that change is good, is the key to being to longevity in my business. I know a lot of photographers who are world-class shooters who now have ID tags that say, my name is Mark, welcome to Walmart, because newspapers and magazines and businesses are folding left, right, and center.
Wow.
And it's all because they didn't get caught up with digital or video or any of the things that modern technology has changed about my gear. So to go back to what I was saying, in the old days, it was prayer photography. You shot something and you pray it would come out.
Right.
You know, nowadays, all that's taken out of it. You know, you shoot a picture and you do what we call chimping in the business, which means if you ever look in the end zone after a touchdown and you see all the photographers as the player is celebrating, you see everybody look down with their chins to their chest, and they're looking at the back of their camera, and they look like chimps. And we call that chimping, because now you're just checking to see if you got the shot.
Right.
Now, really good photographers, like I'd like to think I am, don't even have to bother, because we know we got it.
Right.
But now, you know, it takes a lot of the guesswork out. But there is an example I could give you that can tell you that where luck does come into play. Mark McGwire is at the time, Pro Player Stadium, playing against the Marlins when he was on pace to break the home run record by
right.
Roger Maris. He was sitting on, I think, 56 or 57, which was the National League record for, I believe it was Hack Wilson, who set it at like 58. So even though he was three or four away, they had a three-game series in Miami, and it looked like he had a chance to get to 61 in Miami. So every photographer on the planet that shoots sports is packed into the first base box and the third base box at Pro Player Stadium. Well, McGwire gets up, and I don't remember if it was 57 or 58, but he hits this home run, this monster shot. And I knew that Mark McGwire wasn't the type of guy that did a big hot dog dance. He just ran around the bases, and he did his fist pound at home. So as he connected with the ball, my first job is to get the ball on the bat, get the follow through, because that's the big moment.
So so at that point you're taking you're taking shots with every pitch.
With every pitch, it's just like the extra innings, bottom of the 11th inning of the World Series when the Marlins beat Cleveland.
Right.
Every pitch for those 10th and 11th innings. You're shooting. And by the way, you're shooting film back then. You can't even delete it.
Wow.
I didn't even develop the rolls of film from that World Series that didn't mean anything. I probably have six rolls of undeveloped film still sitting somewhere.
Of just random guys taking swings at the plate.
Yeah, because any shot could have been that game-winning hit.
Wow.
So, in the case of McGwire's shot, you're timing every ball on the bat. And the key is to get the ball coming off the bat, not to follow through or him watching it go out.
Right.
So, you know, the first thing you do is you shoot the follow through. And then I'm sitting there next to Sports Illustrated and ESPN and every major sports shooter. And as he's rounding second base, in the corner of my eye, in center field, and we know the Marlins games aren't as sold out as some other baseball parks, they have a tarps over the seats because there's nobody sitting out there. Well, I could see out of the corner of my eye as McGwire's rounding second, this the young kid running across the tarp to get the ball.
Wow.
And his feet are sinking into the tarp, and it looks really funky from 400 feet away as I'm paying attention to McGuire rounding second. So I go to the kid for a split second, and as he reaches for the ball, I shoot a frame. And then I go back to McGuire, and I get him rounding third, and I get him at home celebrating, and then I look out in center field, and the kid has disappeared. And there's literally nowhere for him to have gone. So I looked at the SI photographer sitting next to me, and I said, you know, I said, Bill, you know, what happened? You see the kid out in center field? And he looked at me, and he said, Sirota, McGuire just hit number 58. What were you? I don't know what you were looking at. And I said, fine. We went in and developed the film. And as my editor is finding that home run shot, I said to him, do you see a picture of the kid? And he's like, what are you talking about? So I keep looking through the negatives with my bare eye, and I see this one frame of the outfield. And I put a loop to it, a magnifying glass, and all you see is two sneakers, Converse sneakers, sticking up out of the tarp.
Wow.
And it fell through a seam in the tarp.
Wow.
And the photo was so strong because it had the center fielder still looking up, and the outfield, and that's the picture that everybody used, including Sports Illustrated.
That's amazing.
And it's funny because a few weeks later, I bumped into that same photographer from SI, and he said to me, you know something, dude? I saw that shot of yours, man, and I had no idea what you were talking about, and you made me look bad. And that was luck. But one thing you say in photography is, if you see it, you missed it. Because as the shutter goes open and closed, it goes black for a second.
Yeah.
So if I would have seen the kid's shoes, I missed it. If
right.
I would have seen the ball on the bat, coming off the bat, I missed it.
Yeah.
So part of that is, it is luck, because if you actually saw the moment through the lens, you missed it.
I was going to get into a little bit more detail about how much luck it is. And as I'm talking to you, I'm thinking that there may be like amateur or, you know, semi-accomplished photographers listening to this and expecting to learn something. And I ask their forgiveness for maybe asking you stupid questions. And
No, that's a good question.
I'm a non-photographer, so I'm going to be asking you non-photographer questions. Let's talk about the difference between a camera that you would have used in 1985 and a camera that you would use in 2011, a digital camera. Now, my experience with some of the cheaper digital cameras, or, you know, home versions of cameras that I've used, is that there's a delay from the time you press the
Absolutely.
Button till the time the picture goes. Is that the case with your high-end cameras as well? And that is where my question about luck lies. If you want to get a guy coming up to dunk a ball, do you have to time it and press the button earlier, or are yours instantaneous?
Well, and again, another great question. There is a delay in every camera. The difference in my high-end, you know, professional gear is the delay is 1/100,000th of a second, as opposed to, you know, 1/1,000th of a second.
Okay.
Okay, which makes all the difference in the world. Now, you still do not shoot what you intend to shoot. You don't push your button doesn't go down at the exact moment you want it to.
Right.
So timing comes into it. Now, when you talk about dunking a basketball or even catching a football, you have a lot more time to collect yourself than you do in, let's say, tennis or baseball.
Yep.
Now, if you try to motor drive a tennis ball hitting a racket, we call it a fried egg because the ball will actually flatten out.
Yep.
If you get it right on the racket.
Yep.
If you're going to try to get a fried egg, you can have a motor drive that goes 10 frames per second, which most of our cameras do nowadays, and you try to drive through it, you will miss it every time. You have to know when your camera's, you know, fires from the time you push the button, and
right.
you have to time it.
Because you're saying 10 frames isn't enough to catch it.
It's not enough to catch a baseball or a tennis. I don't think at any speed you'll actually freeze it if you try to just. I mean, it's 15 frames a second. You might still
right.
miss it 9 out of 10 times.
Right.
You know, the ball is traveling just too fast. If a ball is traveling 80 or 90 miles an hour in any sport, it's like trying to catch a hockey puck. You'll never do it. You have to time it. You have to watch the tennis player bring the racket up and anticipate the contact. You have to watch the goalie move his stick to try to get the puck going over his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
You have to watch the batter start his swing and time it. And you waste a lot of shots on strikes,
yep.
on check swings. You know, you waste a lot of shots. But if you're not timing it, You know, so for me, to answer your question in simplest terms, I don't believe it is luck. I think some of the best pictures people take are luck, as in the case of that Mark McGuire shot.
Yeah.
But if I'm trying to get Federer on a backhand, and remember one other thing, we shoot through very long lenses, you know, big focal ranges. So you're looking at Venus Williams setting up her backhand from her elbows to her elbows, from her waist to her head. If you try to wait to see the ball coming in, you never will get the
right.
Never
you,
time.
You learn a lot about sports body language and stuff in your business, I'm sure.
Human nature, again, you start to understand, like when Marino pats the ball, then he's going to throw.
Right.
You know, you start to understand. I mean, dude, there were times where I could be at a Dolphin New England game and I could watch Marino, and I've covered him for many years, and I'm sure we'll talk about my books and the athletes I've worked with on the book projects. But you know, I could guess what was going to happen, and that's one of the reasons why. And this question may come up, or maybe even thinking about what's my favorite sport. Football has always been my favorite sport to photograph, because you have 100 yards to work on each end,
uh-huh,
and 50 yards in the end, and you can move to what you think is going to happen. Where every other sport, your position is your position, you're in it for the game, and you don't get to move around.
Right.
You know, and that's why I always loved shooting football, because I would look and go, you know, this cornerback's due for an interception. I'm going the other way. And I would wind up being the only person in the opposite end zone when somebody would be high-stepping the touchdown going the other way, because, you know, I anticipated it.
Now, for the sake of those who may be listening that are accomplished photographers and are curious to know what kind of gear you use, of course, I'm sure they can get details at marksirota.com, which we'll post a link on the page here for people to peruse some of your fantastic work and learn more about what you're doing. But talk a little bit about what's the bread and butter of the gear that you're using. And wow, we're running out of time. We got like less than 5 or 6 minutes, and we still want to get to your coffee book stuff.
I'll tell you quick.
And stuff, but talk to us a little bit about what's the heart of your gear, and you know, for some people that might be wondering whether it's this brand or that brand or this type or that type.
Well, I shoot Canon gear, and I've always shot Canon gear. They have a great professional service that they offer. It's called CPS, Canon Professional Services, which means they'll clean your equipment for you. They'll loan you gear when your gear is broken. They treat pros very good. But I've used Canon for many years, and I really like the new systems, the HDSLR, the latest technology. They are the 7Ds and the 5Ds that Canon EOS systems makes, and they shoot high-end, high-def, 30 frames per second, 1080p video, as well as the highest file size available for still photography.
Oh, wow.
They're the best, and that's what, you know, you had me on with Scott, or you talked to Scott Goldman over at our production company. We're doing a lot of multimedia and video off the same cameras we're shooting stills on today.
Wow. And so would it be Canon and Nikon, the two big heavy hitters in the business?
Yeah, but Canon is the leader right now. Nikon has their lenses are known for being better, but as far as Canon revolutionized digital photography, Canon has revolutionized the application of video and the HDSLR systems. Nikon, to be honest with you, in my opinion, has fallen way behind. And even their newer cameras that they're putting out to compete with Canon are maybe slightly better, because they're the newest things out. They dropped the ball several years ago. Canon's the leader.
All right. Well, you heard it from the horse's mouth. All right. In our closing moments here, and I don't mean like I'm rushing or anything. We're more than welcome to go over. But there's two other things I want to touch on. I want to talk a little bit about some of the exciting and sometimes maybe life-threatening and scary situations you've been in as a photographer. And then, of course, the work you've accomplished in your coffee table books. I know of only a few of them off the top of my head, and you'll have to fill me in on the rest of them that are out there. Elian Gonzalez, you covered him. You covered the Democrats. National Convention in 2004, election rallies in 2008, the many Florida hurricanes that we've had over the last decade, Hurricane Katrina. You were at Gitmo in Cuba as well?
Yeah, I was actually there right after 9/11 when they started to bring in the Al-Qaeda prisoners and Al-Qaeda prisoners from Afghanistan. And they started those interrogations that are widely discussed today. So I spent 13 days at Gitmo and, covering the Camp X-Ray and the prisoners being taken to interrogation. And I was a part of the, unfortunately, the tragedy of 9/11 in that manner. When we talk about the hurricanes in Katrina, I covered Katrina both from the air. I did aerial photography for several days.
Wow.
Over New Orleans, and then I was on the ground in the Superdome for a couple of days. And you know, it's funny because I've been in some hairy situations. I've heard bullets go over my head in the West Indies and in Grenada and Haiti, and I've heard tragedy and death in front of me in all sorts of manners, but I never felt as afraid or in danger as I did in the New Orleans Superdome during that period of time. And I had just been there for the Arena Bowl, and I've been there for Super Bowls and Sugar Bowls, and yet I'm standing in the same building that I've always been so happy and comfortable in, and I was fearing for my life. You know, the Ilian Gonzalez saga was a whole different situation because it was a 5-month story.
I mean,
it went on every day. It was me, the AP, AFP, I think it was, Agence France-Presse, out in front of his house for 3 months before any of the media showed up other than us.
Wow.
I mean, and then by the time it ended, we were actually set up on the street across from his house in tents, with phone lines dropped from the poles so we could transmit, that Bell South installed on the street. I mean, it was a bizarre assignment. And, you know, and the fact that I happened to be there the morning of the raid, when they took him, and, you know, witnessed that with the agents kicking the door in and then dragging this young kid out the front door, was unbelievable. And all I kept thinking back then was, it's like a football game, believe it or not. Just get the guy with the ball.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so much chaos and tear gas. It was 5 o'clock on, I think, Easter Sunday morning.
Right.
There was hundreds of protesters on the street. There was hundreds of photographers. And, you know, my shift was always the midnight to 5 a.m. shift. And because they never thought anything was going to go on back then, so they wanted to, you know, put me out there on the longest shift and through the night, because I'd be there just in case to crush it. But most likely, I was going to, you know, I was just going to sit in a camping chair and smoke cigars with other shooters. And to be there the morning of that raid and have it go down, I'll tell you, there were 200 photographers out there that morning, and maybe 5 or 6 people made a picture.
Wow!
Because when guns are pointed and tear gas is going and people are screaming, most people, professional or not, journalist or not, I don't care what, you find out what's inside of you.
Yep.
Because you want to watch like a fire. You want to just watch. And when this kid came out the front door in the arms of that female INS agent, and the guys behind her had guns in their hands, and everybody was screaming, and most people froze. And, you know, I think there may be 5 or 6 of us, the LA Times, the Boston Globe, me, AP. I think maybe the Sun Sentinel got it. The Miami Herald blew it, flat out blew it. I think their photographer fell face first in the dirt and blamed somebody else for his mistake. But
wow.
Very few people actually made a picture, because in those moments, you have to just, I looked at it as though, just get it sharp. And, you know, get the guy with the ball, you know, it's kind of the way I looked at it.
You lose your ability to, you know, sensibly reason at that point, you know, it's like,
But those kind of moments, there's something about news photography. I fancy myself mostly a sports shooter these days, and, you know, and I like doing iconic portraits more than anything nowadays. But, you know, those days were exhilarating, and they taught me more than ever that, that I was, you know, built for it, because I always came home with a shot.
Well, and you did a great job of putting into words, you know, how you felt in those situations, which was I was hoping to be able to ask you about, but you've done that very nicely. We're talking with Mark Sirota, and on one final note, you have put together a number of memorable, I guess you call them coffee table books, photography books, and a few of them that I know off the top of my head are the Mario Lemieux book, Troy Aikman, John Elway, Dan Marino. You've done a number of them since. Talk a little bit about how you got the idea to do these and how you got started. Was the Marino book the first one you did?
Yeah, and what had happened with that is, you know, shortly after the Michael Jordan coffee table book came out, it was called Rare Air. you know, people of our generation probably remember it. It was a white cover, a picture of Michael,
In
a white towel. It was shot in South Beach on the roof of a hotel, and it was a $50 photo-driven pictorial biography, one of the first of its kind. And when I saw that book, I was inspired because Marino was about to break the four biggest records in quarterback history.
Right.
That year in 94. And I believe the Jordan book might have come out in 92 or 93. But I saw this book and I thought, what you really need to make a successful book is you need relevance and you need something going on. And I approached Marino, and it's funny, I sent a photo of him running a touchdown into the end zone, which he did probably once in his career, and
right.
That was that day. And I sent it to camp because there were rumors he might, you know, not sign a new contract and go to the Steelers or something that year. And I just sent him a note saying, look, I don't do this. I'm not a homer, but I wanted you to have this picture. And, you know, you mean a lot to this town and to us as journalists, and I'd love for you to stay. And I got a call from his dad, Mr. Dan Marino Sr., who was a very dear friend of mine till the day he passed. And he set up a meeting with Danny, and I told him, I saw this Michael Jordan book, and I want to do a book on you. You're going to break the passing records of touchdowns, completions, yardage, and attempts this year, and I think we can make a book. And he went into his back office and brought out an old black-and-white coffee table book on Joe Namath.
Wow.
And said, I've been collecting this. It was signed by Joe, and he said, if you could do something like this, then let's do it. And we did the first book, and then every book I did after that was a vanity thing because John Elway and Troy Aikman and Brett Favre and Kurt Warner, they all wanted to do it because Danny did it, and that was my selling point. So
very nice.
We're very fortunate. Danny and I have done several books since. We're very, very good friends. And every book I've done since then has been a result of the fact that he said yes that day.
And these are still available. Can they be ordered online on your website?
Well, no, they can be ordered. Just go to Amazon.com.
Oh, sure, sure.
And if you put in my name as an author,
right,
you'll see all my books. I've done Dwayne Wade. I have a book with Magic Johnson and Larry Bird. My Britney Spears book, as I said.
All right. Well, then there we go. We'll put a link for that page at Amazon up on the show page as well, so people can browse those and maybe pick up a book or two as well. It's it's really worth going through there. It's like you turn every page and you basically say wow with every page turn. So
yeah, and what we did too, one of the big things I liked about Michael Jordan's book is there was a picture of him in a bubble bath with his kids with bubbles all over.
Wow.
And I thought to myself, you never see that in Sports Illustrated. So when we did our books, we got Marino trick-or-treating in full costume with his kids.
Right.
And we got we got him at his sister's wedding speaking in church. And we used images that were, you know, would tell you a little bit about the person rather than the athlete.
Wow. That and very, very well done. Mark, I really appreciate you taking the time to share these stories with us. It's even more fascinating than I thought it would be. And I also hope the photographers are satisfied with the subject matter we covered. So.
Oh, absolutely. And by the way, for all you shooters out there, again, I recommend highly, highly exploring video if you haven't already. Get involved in HDSLR. I have a company called Love Home Productions with my oldest friend, Scott Goldman, that, you know, you can go to lovehomeproductions.com as well and see my video work and some of the multimedia projects we're working on. I really recommend that if this is something that you want to do, stay up with the technology, try whatever's out there, and stay modern, because if not, you know, you'll be one of those people who said, I used to be a photographer.
I don't think there's any problem with today's generation growing up and keeping things modern, because everything is just basically modern by default these days. But very valuable information there, Mark. I really appreciate it. And on that note, I could actually use, and this is something ultimately it would be a dream to have you do something like this for me, but I need to put together some promotional videos for this show that I can start spreading around on YouTube. Perhaps if there's an up-and-coming photographer or videographer out there that wants to do something that, like that for me on an intern kind of basis and sit in on a couple of shows and observe and shoot some video, contact me at murph@billmurphyshow.com. It would be a great start for somebody, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I'd actually like to recommend that to some of the students at the Art Institute or people that I've worked with or am working with. I'll do that as well, Bill.
Well, there you go. Networking at its finest. Mark Sirota, our guest today on the show. I appreciate you joining me, buddy, and let's get together and have a cold one soon.
Absolutely, Bill. Love to do it.
Hang on for 1 second and we'll say goodbye. In the meantime, everybody, tune in again tomorrow for another new show. We're going to have the Barron Sisters on this week for Music Friday. They've just been signed and they're going to celebrate by playing here in the studio for us before the week is done. Catch you back here tomorrow with another brand new show.
Log on each weekday for another edition of The Bill Murphy Show at BillMurphyShow.com. If you'd like to be a guest, send an email to Murph@BillMurphyShow.com. That's MURPH@BillMurphyShow.com. A Murphonics Media Production.